Welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. It goes to me to say that the last few seasons would have been literally impossible without the support of my two amazing sponsors. So let me take just a second to mention them now. Water for Fighting is brought to you by Resource Environmental Solutions and Sea and Shoreline. RES is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at www.res.us. And of course, Sea and Shoreline. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator in protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at www.cnshoreline.com. All right, on with the show. Today, I'm joined by a former tight end for a Division I college football program, legislative affairs director at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, an Eagle Scout on top of that, a member of the Three Daughters Club, and he's currently a lobbyist with Capital City Consulting. If you heard all that and you know I'm talking about Andrew Ketchell, who is no stranger to the legislative process, or a glass of whiskey for that matter. Andrew, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Brett. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming in on a especially weird day. By the time folks hear this, it'll have long since gone, but we're looking down the barrel of Hurricane Helene. It's a Wednesday as we talk about this. It's supposed to be here like tomorrow night, right? As they always do. Like, it's great that hurricanes show up in the middle of the night. But to that end, thanks for coming in anyway. Give me some of your time, and I know that y'all are anxious to prepare and get out of town. How are those preparations going for you?
Everything's good. Yeah, we're just most concerned about infrastructure and trees falling, et cetera. So not having electricity for an extended period of time with three kids under six is not ideal. So probably get out of town for a few days.
Yeah, I have older one that they left town with their mom earlier this morning. And so it's easier that way. So I just have two dogs who do a different kind of whining, but it is what it is. And so we've known each other, I think, well over a decade now. And it's been great to get to know you better in recent years. But let's go back a little further. Your parents lived in the Florida Panhandle for decades now, but they're not from there, are they?
That's correct. My mom is from mostly Western Maryland, parts of Pennsylvania. My dad was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and was the son of an Air Force sergeant. So they came down to the Florida Panhandle in the late 1950s when he was about 18 months old. And he grew up there. And then mom grew up in Hagerstown area, which is in Western Maryland. They joined forces in Washington, D.C. after a long period of time. There were things that obviously happened in between them. But
yeah, I got a chance to, and she's a really cool lady. I got a chance to meet your mom, Carolyn, on a number of occasions, even worked with her a bit in some uncomfortable circumstances. And she acquitted herself quite well. But let's talk about her a little bit more. It's like, because we'll get to you in the end, but I'm kind of winding this path from both of your parents' experiences, both personal and then professional, that ends up with them in D.C. meeting, and then you and your brother obviously come after that. Tell me about, what does she study in school?
It's kind of an interesting story because she grew up in Maryland, so there was, the D.C. scene was a part of everybody's life. She lived about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes from D.C., so they spent quite a bit of time there as kids, and so she, like a lot of young people, got bit by the bug. She studied social work at a local college there in Western Maryland, and then got a master's degree actually at Florida State, but she studied social work. She decided that she would put her duties as a social worker to test in D.C. as a staffer. So she worked for a couple committees, worked ultimately for the Ways and Means Committee, was a part of writing part of the Social Security Act during the Reagan administration. So she was a part of that rework, which is pretty unique. And Ways and Means Committee, for those of you who don't know, in D.C. is an incredibly powerful committee. So she was pretty high-level staffer there. And then spent after I mean, we could talk about that too, but after they ended up getting married and moving back to the Panhandle, she went back into social work. So she completely left the political scene for better part of 25 years while dad did his thing as a lawyer And then she ran for the county commission after that.
Yeah, we'll get to the why in a little bit. Let's talk about your dad and how he ended up, because he ended up in D.C. as well, right?
Yeah, he did. So he grew up in Fort Walton Beach, which is where I grew up in the 60s and part of the 70s. And then he went to Duke University in the early 70s and actually played football there as well. So that's where I get my athletic talent from, played football there. And then just like mom, got bit by the political bug and decided to move to D.C. as well. So he worked for couple members of Congress, and they met on the Hill. So they met on the Hill working in different capacities, and then ultimately made their way back to the Florida Panhandle, Northwest Florida.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm talking about your dad. Did he go to law school at Duke as well, or is it undergrad?
That's a good point. I didn't mention that. So he did his undergrad at Duke, and then he went took a period of time doing a few different things. Went to the University of Florida for law school. And then he moved up to D.C. So that was kind of the path to victory for him. But I don't think, like, if you ask him today, he's in his late 60s. If you ask him today, is that what he thought he would do? And we'll talk about some of the other things he's done. Probably wouldn't say, like, yeah, I mean, I just went to law school because I thought that was the right thing to do. And there were a lot of successful people that went to law school. Ironically, he grew up in a very kind of middle class, lower class setting when he grew up in Northwest Florida. But then when he went to Duke, because of sports, because of football, he met a lot of kind of highfalutin people, a lot of doctors, a lot of lawyers, a lot of people that ran in those circles. And so that's what changed his life, quite frankly, and introduced him to a different kind of life that he could lead and got the idea to go to law school.
What did his parents, I know you covered the, I think it was Army Air Corps or the Air Force.
Air Force.
And so what did his parents do after that?
Yeah, his dad was in the Air Force. I think he got up to a sergeant. He was an enlisted guy in the Air Force. Him and his mother got divorced when he was 10 or 12. He moved to Jacksonville. His mother, my grandmother, who's since passed away, was a mortgage broker. So she was kind of like one of the early female mortgage brokers in Northwest Florida back then. She kind of broke some ceilings there. And it was a very modest existence. I actually went back years ago and visited the house that they lived in. It was a very, very modest existence. They lived on the Sound there and kind of near Navarre for a number of years. So, but yeah, so it really was the sports. You know, everybody talks about how sports get you out. It really was the sports transition that got him into the professional world, because without that he wouldn't have had any of those experiences. He probably just would have not gone to college and stayed behind and done whatever the local work, but it kind of changed his life in that regard.
It's a big deal. Obviously Duke's never been an enormous, other than basketball, sporting school. It's like, but it is a learning school. And so,
well, somehow it's crazy, because somehow he had the wherewithal to know. So he got offered by the University of Alabama, Auburn University, Duke, and Vanderbilt. Those were his four big offers. And somehow he had the wherewithal to go meet with Bear Bryant in the early 70s and say, I don't want to come here. I don't want to come here because this is basically just a sports school and I value my education. I want to be a student athlete. I don't just want to be an athlete. Yeah. And that was what the University of Alabama was back in the early 70s. You played football first and then you went to school second.
Did he ever relate? Did Bear Bryant ever say anything like that? Memorable in terms of that conversation?
I asked him this question actually recently, because I went to a game at my alma mater played University of Alabama. So I asked him this question. He said that at the time, so he went and met with him in his office. He took an official visit up there. He went and met with him in his office, and he was in the latter part of his career. So he was an old man at that point. And he said he recalled him being kind of a curmudgeon and come here if you'd like. We're not forcing you to come here. It wasn't like a hard sell. And dad wasn't, you know, really a blue chip kind of guy. I mean, he was a great athlete and good, obviously good at football, but he wasn't like, you know, one of the best offensive linemen in the country or whatever. So he kind of remember him being a bit of a curmudgeon, but he did meet with them and he did ultimately decide he didn't want to go to Alabama. So it was, I mean, most guys that age would never have done that. I mean, that guy was you think of Nick Saban as kind of a college football icon or college football god, but Bear Bryant back then was the guy. Like, he was the college football god. And dad kind of thought, I want to do more than that. I see this opportunity. I know Duke's a good school. I don't know how it's going to change my life, but
right,
I think it's going to change my life. Somehow he was able to figure that out.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, given in many people that, if you're from South Florida, Central Florida, you may not know this, but your neck of the woods, that side of the panhandle is very much not a Florida State, Florida, Miami place. It is Alabama, Auburn
Correct.
Kind of place.
Correct.
They feel, I mean, they almost feel like they are Alabamans.
Part of the LA, you know, lower Alabama. Yep,
that's right. Yeah. And so skipping that is a big deal. Talk about So he finishes law school, and they're both in D.C. at this point. How did they end up meeting?
Yeah, so they met working on the Hill. They ran in similar circles because of the work that they did. Mom was a, quote-unquote, a professional staffer, and Dad was a staffer of a member, so it was a bit of a different dynamic. But like a lot of young people running around the D.C. scene, they met each other and had a lot in common. Fast-forwarding to they get married. They are actually living in Annapolis because Dad really wanted to be by the water because he grew up along the water. So they were commuting. Today, that commute would be nearly impossible. It's probably 2 hours of traffic.
But yeah,
back then, you could do it in probably an hour 15 without traffic or with minimal traffic. So they were commuting like an hour and 15, an hour every day back and forth.
Wow.
And they had my brother. And when he was maybe a year old-ish, they decided to move back to the Panhandle. So Dad at that point had moved on working for a law firm locally, and he convinced them to open a Florida practice. They didn't have a Florida practice.
Okay.
Probably the ideal scenario would be moving to Florida, like in Tampa or Miami, to open a Florida practice, not Northwest Florida, that which was not populated then, or at least the way it is now. So he moved back, opened the local branch of that firm, and got convinced by the local Republican Party that it would be a good idea to run for Congress. And at this point, he was in his late 20s, early 30s. This was in 1990 that he ran. And at the time, it was the Panhandle was basically a combination of CD1 and CD2. So it ran from Congressional District 1, ran from Pensacola all the way to almost to Tallahassee. It was a massive congressional district in terms of, and it was a blue district. It had been a blue district since Reconstruction. And it was kind of turning. There was a lot of blue dogs, a lot of quote-unquote conservatives. There were still Democrats that generation.
Yeah.
And they ran some polling data, and they were like, listen, we think that it's turning purple, and we think that it can be flipped. So there was a guy named Earl Hutto that had been in office for a long time. I think he had been in 10 terms, 12 terms, so mm-hmm. a long time, and was kind of asleep at the wheel. And they had this young guy that came in and ran against him. He raised a lot of money. There was a lot of activity. He worked his butt off to kind of get in front of the right people and almost beat Earl Hutto. I mean, mm-hmm. so he lost by like less than 2 points. And the party, the National Party, then got a bit involved, although he was running out of money. I mean, there's not a ton of money in the Panhandle, and
yeah.
he was draining all his resources to do it. Ran again in 92, and at that point, the National Democratic Party and Earl Hutto himself woke up, and he ended up losing by like 3. But there's been a lot of political science type kind of literature and articles written on that race, because that was the race that then really flipped it to a purpley red seat.
Right.
And the rest is history. So obviously it's probably the safest Republican congressional seat in the country, if not top 5.
Yeah.
It's the seat now that Matt Gaetz has, but back then it was much larger and the dynamic was a bit different. But so he took his foray and did his foray into national politics. And yeah, I think it changed his life. And it would have been interesting if he would have won. It would have changed all of our lives. We would have spent a lot of time in D.C. and who knows where my brother and I would be and all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. so after he lost in 92, he did not rejoin that firm. He opened his own law practice and hung his own shingle. And did that for the better part of almost 25 years, or 20-ish years.
What's your mom doing at this time?
So mom's a social worker. So she goes
to the county or the state? Or
no, something? she worked for a couple different. So she went back and got her master's at FSU at night. Back then there was no online classes, obviously. Mm. So she would go over like Thursday, Friday, weekends and do it for a couple years. She did. I remember that as a kid. She coming over to Dallas and doing that. It was a huge sacrifice for her and for all of us to do that. She got her master's and then she got her licensed clinical social worker, which is an extra certification, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think she was one of the first in the Panhandle to have it. So she did a bunch of different things. She worked at a hospital. She worked at a kind of her own office. She had her own practice for a long time. So she did that, I mean, basically during the same time that Dad was practicing law for a long time, 20 or 25 years. And then she ran for the commission actually after I left for college. And so Dad, same thing. The year I left for college, I believe in 2006, is when he won his election, or maybe it was the next year. He ran for circuit court. There was a seat that opened up in the first circuit. He ran for circuit court judge, mm-hmm. and he won. And so he's been on the bench ever since.
What year was that?
2006, I think.
And for your mom making it on the commission?
So I think I want to say she ran right after I left college-ish, maybe 2000 and 2012, 2013, but she's been on the bench for a long time. I mean, you know, almost 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, it's
been almost, not the bench, the commission.
Yeah. And I'm not sure we've mentioned yet, for folks that don't know the Panhandle well, we're talking Okaloosa County, which is very unlike it was when your father was a kid. Let me get to you. When did you come along?
Yeah, so I was born in 1987. I was, they had not bought, my parents still live in the same house that I grew up in, but they had not bought, when they moved to the back to the Panhandle, my mom was pregnant with me. We moved into a rental house kind of nearby where my dad's folks lived. So that's where I was born. I was born in 87, and then we moved into the house that we live in now, that they live in now, that they lived in for the better part of whatever, 36 years. 35 years. And yeah, so I'm actually the only native Floridian in my family, which I tell them all the time. I think is an interesting little fact, but my brother missed it by about a year, so we born and raised in Okaloosa County, lived in the same house and went to the same high school as my dad. Great place to grow up. Obviously, Fort Walton Beach, Shalimar, that whole area, kind of the north end, middle end of Okaloosa County. And then it was about the same as it was back then. Crestview has obviously exploded, the north end. And then obviously the south end, Destin, is completely different than it was.
Yeah, it's very much a military town in a lot of ways. I mean, it's in everything that's there, especially on the south end of the county. But essentially everyone that works at the base lives in Crestview as well. And so it's really blown up. Did you live close to the water?
No, I mean, a little bit. Yeah, we lived kind of near Lake Loraine, which is a little lake there, but kind of near the bay. Yeah, I grew up in Shalimar, which is about 15 minutes from the ocean, and we grew up 3 miles from the back entrance of Eglin Air Force Base. So, I mean, to your point about military town, all my friends' parents were in the military. Many of my friends from grade school on through high school went into the military because their dads were in the military. That was the connection to the area. Everybody came to that area because of the military. It may not have been their parents, may have been their grandparents, whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's why we were there, obviously. It's why most folks are there. So big part of the fabric and culture of that region.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a history of my family a little farther west. It's like, but my dad graduated from high school in Escambia County in Pensacola, and my mom was born over there, but their families are not from there. Mm-hmm. Both of their fathers were Navy pilots. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a interesting dynamic over there.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do when you were a kid?
Man, I lived a pretty normal life as a kid. Obviously, I was really into sports. I was kind of a natural fit. My dad did a lot of sports as a kid, and that's kind of what I just got into. And kind of towards my elementary, middle school years, I got into scouts pretty heavy. That's where I kind of gained my love for the outdoors and spent a lot of time outdoors. And so, I mean, that was my life. I went to a really small Catholic school all the way from kindergarten through 8th grade, and then went to a not so little, very large public high school, Choctawhatchee High School, which is where my dad went. It's a little bit smaller now than when I was there, but so it was an interesting dynamic going from little St. Mary's Catholic School on Fort Walton Beach.
Is that a hard transition? I mean, people don't know you. You're like 6'5", and so the idea that you would get picked on is pretty small. It's like, but the culture shock had to have been there.
It was a big change for me. But ironically, sports is what provided me a bit of an in. I mean, it's what kind of kept me on the cool kid side of things and allowed me to kind of fit in very quickly because I played with the guys that were playing all the sports that I was playing with. And so the transition was a huge shock, but that made it a bit easier, you know, after a few years, you kind of get used to it. But it's a big school. And then it was like, I don't know, 2,200 kids or something. Mm-hmm. So my little Catholic school had, in totality, I think it had like 500 kids.
Wow.
Little tiny. And so, but yeah, sports and scouts, big part of my life, and lived a very, very, very fortunate existence, honestly. It was loving parents, great brother, small family, that kind of thing. So it was very fortunate.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation. Talk about Scouts just a little bit. I've always been curious. I made it through those early years, the Cub Scouts and Weeblos, but never the Boy Scouts. Being an Eagle Scout, talk about what was your project?
Yeah, so the Scouts for me was interesting because I think really the troop that you're a member of is what makes a difference. If you don't have a good troop and good leaders, you're not going to like it. So what was cool about Boy Scouts in that area is that all of the dads and a few moms that were involved were all military guys. Mm. So we did a lot of cool stuff. I mean, we shot cool guns. We camped in great places. We did survival school at the Ranger camp on Eglin Air Force Base. We did a lot of cool stuff. And the guys that I hung around with, they knew a lot about the outdoors and knew about all the things that you need to learn about as a scout. So for me, it was a cool experience. It wasn't just like knots and boring meetings. So, yeah. And I think what pushed me into becoming an Eagle Scout was that I went through with five other guys that were all my brother's age. So I ended up getting my Eagle Scout really, really young. I was in eighth grade when I got it, which is pretty unique. Most guys are like, girls are like in high school or whatever. Yeah. But I wanted to get it done because I knew sports was coming up and my life was busy. So my project was ironically in the natural resources space. The longleaf pine habitat was dwindling. There's a huge longleaf pine habitat on Eglin Air Force Base. But before we knew the significance of it for red cockaded woodpeckers and other critters, we logged a bunch of longleaf pines on Eglin Air Force Base. Hmm. So my project was replanting a big section of habitat that once existed in longleaf pines. Actually, I haven't been back because it was in the middle of nowhere. But we were learning more about woodpeckers and their habitat and what that tree species looks for them and why it's important. And so I brought a bunch of guys out in the middle of the woods. We replanted a bunch of trees, mm-hmm. built a couple benches, did a couple things. And so it was cool. That's ironic. I hadn't until this point made that connection that's part of my life now. But
yeah. I mean, and it's a huge part of life in the panhandle as well in terms of restoring those forests. Mm-hmm. It's probably a good time to go back and check it out. It's like that. You're probably getting to the age where it's starting to become decent sized trees.
Yeah. That was in like 2000.
Yeah.
So yeah, 25 years.
I mean,
I don't even know. Honestly, I can't remember where it's at. I'd have to go back and look. I don't even know how I would find it, but I probably should go do that at some point.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
It's cooler than the bench. I've seen the bench deal a lot. I'm like,
gazebos.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cool. It was a cool project. But the guy, there's like a review board that reviews all these Eagle Scouts and their projects and stuff. And I remember that it was like, at the time, it was a bunch of like old guys. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is now, but they do have it for different regions. They were very skeptical because I was so young. They really put me through the ringer, making sure that I knew what the heck I was doing mm-hmm. and that I had sufficient experience to get it. So yeah, it's something I'm proud of. It's like any of your accomplishments at a young age, you gotta have a little intestinal fortitude to push through when you don't really want to do it. You want to do other things like just do ridiculous things. I'm sure that
carried forward later on, especially in college. But before I get into your time in college, was there a point, out of curiosity, during those days of the Boy Scouts where you considered joining the military? You're around a lot of military guys. My dad was military, grandfather. I'm like, it was pretty cool. I didn't think I was going to do it. I did, but did you think about it?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, basically, so of the guys that got our Eagle Scout awards together, all of them except for my brother and I went in the military. Hmm. And they all are doing crazy stuff, special ops. One's a helicopter pilot in the Navy. I mean, well, I don't know if they still are. It's been a long time, but they were for a long time. And my brother and I both thought about it. And quite frankly, had our dad been in the military, we probably would have done it. I think sports derailed me a bit. The service academies all offered me coming out of high school. And I ended up turning them down because I actually had an experience with a couple older guys that did it. And they were like, you don't have a life. I mean, the life of going to the Air Force Academy or going to West Point is already difficult. Mm-hmm. But then on top of that, you throw in an extra like 15 or 20 hours of sports, which is not a lot for the typical Division I athlete. But doing that on top of all your service academy duties, I mean, it was almost untenable. They just didn't have any life outside of sports and academy duty. So because of that, I just kind of decided I wanted a college experience.
Yeah.
You know, and so talk sports probably choice. Pushed it. Sports probably pushed it in that direction.
Well, talk about the choice there. I mean, like you said, you lived in Lower Alabama. Talk about who was knocking on the door and then why you ended up making the choice that you did.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I got offered by a lot of D1AA schools up in the Northeast, several big D1 schools, places like UCF and FIU and FAU, Southern Miss. So there's like, that would be mid-major, Middle Tennessee State, mid-major. Got offered by a couple Ivies as well, but they don't offer athletic scholarships. So that was an interesting dynamic. It was too expensive to go. A few of the service academies, and then USF. And so USF had been on my radar, but kids from the Panhandle didn't go to USF because it was too far away. I mean, it was like 6.5-hour drive. So everybody is much closer to go to FSU or West Florida or, to your point, Auburn, or even go to Tuscaloosa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they offered me, and there was a kid at my school that we both actually signed at USF together, and he was a better player than me, there's no doubt. So he got offered by Alabama and a few other schools and got in trouble. And basically Alabama reneged on their scholarship offer, and then he didn't make grades and had to go to community college. But he rejoined me 2 years later at USF. So we actually signed at USF together. And I think a large part of the reason I got the offer was because they were there. They were there checking me out, but they were really there checking him out. And the way that it works typically is you have... So I really want to go to Duke, obviously, because of my dad. But the way it works is they have literally, it's called a big board. And it's literally a big board. And it's probably digitized now, but back then it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it's hanging in the coach's office, and they line out all their needs at every position. So how many quarterbacks you need, if any. How many running backs you need, if any. How many defensive ends you need, if any. So on any given year, there's only a couple tight ends on a team.
Right.
So like in the NFL, they'll never keep more than two or three tight ends because they have a 53 roster rule. But in college, it's kind of the same way. They probably have three scholarship tight ends and maybe a walk-on.
Mm-hmm.
And the walk-on could be a fullback and a tight end or whatever. So at the time, USF was losing several tight ends, and Duke wasn't. Duke had a few, and then they were offering a few.
Mm-hmm.
So they told me, listen, you're number three on the big board. We're going to offer these two guys right here. If one of them doesn't commit, then you're next. And both of those guys committed.
Hmm.
So one of them had a All-American career at Duke.
Yeah.
One of them transferred after 1 year to UCF and was terrible, ended up kind of doing nothing. So I ended up picking USF because I wanted to go to a big school. I wanted to stay in Florida. And that was our second year in the Big East. So we were now officially in what's now called a Power Five conference. Back then it wasn't.
Right.
And I was like, this is big time football. It was in Tampa.
Yeah.
Ironically, I hadn't spent much time in Tampa. I mean, I'd maybe been to Tampa like once in my entire life, you know. But
did the visit and everything.
Did the visit, loved all the guys. We played at Raymond James Stadium, which we're still playing at Raymond James Stadium now. And we're moving on to building our own on-campus stadium, which will be open in 2027. But it was kind of a weird thing where I decided that I wanted to stay in Florida ultimately. Going to a school in Florida, I thought that there would probably be a better transition or bridge to staying in Florida for a career path. It was pretty easy to say, like, yeah, I'm going to this huge school. At the time, it was a decent school academically. It wasn't what it is now, not even close.
Right.
But it was a decent school in the Big East. Played at a pro-style stadium. I mean, it was just a all-around fantastic opportunity and ended up committitting.
And those are both, I mean, Leroy Selman was the athletic director then.
Yep.
Was Jim Leavitt the coach at
that point? Jim Leavitt was the coach, yeah. He was the guy that started the program in 97 at the helm of Leroy Selman. And he stayed there all the way through till the very end of my college career, and he got fired that last year. And then I played for 1 year for Skip Holtz.
Hmm.
Yep.
Let's talk about the student part of the student-athlete equation, because you end up getting not just a bachelor's degree, I think it's in political science, right? But you also did a master's of
public administration.
Yeah, MPA. Yeah. Tell me about the challenges of playing at a football at a high level, playing against the University of Florida's and people like that, but also getting good enough grades to finish school and then begin your postgraduate while you're still playing.
Yeah, it requires a certain level of discipline, no doubt. It was hard. I got really fortunate because I went to a school that a bit took a chance on because at the time we weren't a great football school, but we were getting better. And I saw the out of conference schedule, and we ended up playing UF and FSU and Miami and Clemson and Auburn and all these great places. But at the time, there was no like dreams of beating any of those beating in those schools, and we did. We beat several of them. So the football side of it, I just frankly lucked out. I mean, I was there at the right time, playing for the right folk. So that was great. But yeah, I mean, I think it's time management. It's a difficult, I mean, there's a level of maturity that you have to have as a young guy or a young girl being a student athlete to say, there's a certain amount of time I got to devote to school, certain time you got to devote to football, and then a certain time you got to devote to just being a kid in college.
Yeah.
And managing all those things are difficult. I would say balancing of all of them, I did a pretty good job doing. Focusing more on football, I probably didn't do as good a job doing. I probably could have put more into becoming a better football player, spending more time in the weight room, watching more film. But I decided that I wanted to have more of a balanced life, which would include joining a fraternity towards the latter half of my college career, really focusing on school because I knew that that was important. I also realized relatively early on that I wasn't going to go pro. I mean, I wasn't good enough to go pro. I mean, yeah. I started games, I caught footballs, I blocked a lot of big dudes, but I wasn't good enough to play in the NFL. So I made that conscious decision to have more of a well-rounded college career because of that. And I was one of the first guys to transition from undergrad to graduate school. And now there's a lot of kids that are doing it at USF, but back then it was a relatively novel concept. And in fact, I remember talking to the academic advisors and some of the assistant ADs, and they pushed back on me because it was like three times more expensive. They wanted me to get a second undergraduate degree. And I remember having conversations. I'm like, guys, what's the point of that? Like, what's the value to me as a student athlete to get a second undergraduate degree? I don't want to do that. I want to go to grad school. And I've gotten into grad school. I've taken the GRE. I've done all these things. I've gotten in. So they ultimately signed up because they kind of had to, but they pushed back. I mean, I remember having those conversations, and now a lot of kids do that. And obviously COVID changed the dynamic and all these other things because kids are staying in school for 6-7 years. So there's a lot of guys since I've left that not just started their master's degree, but finished it or got 2 degrees and a master's degree because they were there for so long.
Yeah.
But that was a relatively novel concept.
So you've got your degree, you've got your graduate degree. Both of your parents are, I think at that point, elected officials, weren't they?
I don't think mom was yet, but okay. She was maybe running for it or in the process of thinking about it.
So, I mean, let me get right to it. Were you always looking at getting involved in the family business, or is just something that, hey, you got to pick a major. It's kind of an interesting subject. Family spent a lot of time in DC.
No, the answer is no, absolutely not. So my brother went to, like most people, you follow the things that your family does, right? I mean, that's the experience you have of people that you trust. So my brother was in law school when I was in grad school and finishing up college at FSU. So he did his undergrad and grad at Florida State, or undergrad and law school at Florida State. And through that experience, I decided I don't think I really want to go to law school. And I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I knew what my dad did for a living. I didn't really want to be a lawyer. But I like the process. I like history. I liked public policy. I like the formation of public policy. I followed politics generally at a national and state level and realized pretty early on that was something that interested me. The story isn't really all that crazy. I mean, basically what happened is I needed a pretty easy transition from undergrad to graduate school. At USF, there was no law school. There still isn't a law school. Mm-hmm. So I needed a seamless transition from undergrad to grad school. And so I picked master's in public administration because of that very reason. I knew that I probably wanted to work in government at some point because it interested me. And for those of you who don't know what an MPA is, it's essentially an MBA for the public sector. I mean, in fact, there's a lot of the same classes, but you add in a little ethics or public policy or whatever and into the mix, and that's the degree. Mm-hmm. So that was the transition. And I actually didn't finish my MPA. I finished at USF, but I didn't finish it in Tampa. I finished my MPA up here.
Interesting.
So the story goes that it was in Tampa. I was at USF. I'd finished my football career. So it was the semester after and was taking grad classes. And one day I walked over to the Office of National Scholarships, which is a kind of a student resource center on campus. And I walked in and a lady came up to me and said, hey, can I help you? And I said, yeah. So what I'm thinking about, I don't really know what to do. I mean, frankly, I wasn't getting the resource help that I needed through athletics. I decided a few years into that process that they were not going to be helpful, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I was like over their head and things that they could provide for me.
Right.
And so I did it on my own. So had a very long conversation with this lady, wonderful lady. I don't think she still works there. She said, well, you can intern here, you do this, but there's this thing called the Florida Gubernatorial Fellowship that kind of just came across my desk, and it's a relatively new program. We've never had anybody from USF get it. We've had a few people apply, but you have to move to Tallahassee. And nobody ever wants to move to Tallahassee if you get it. And I'm like, oh man, that's great. So I read about it and I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. It's like one of those happened circumstances. So I applied, got it, moved to Tallahassee, transferred my stuff as a transient student to FSU, and then I graduated with my master's degree from USF. So I finished those last few classes, took a class from Governor Askew, since passed away, which is the MPA school is named after.
Yeah.
That was a great experience. So it was just a wonderful experience. But that's what really led me to moving to Tallahassee, and I've been here ever since, was that experience. Hmm. You think about those points in your life where it's like, I remember, like, what was the turning point? That was like a meeting that was a turning point. Otherwise, I would have never known that that program even existed.
Did you have any other influences at USF? I graduated from Florida State, but had a couple of great professors. I was more of a history side of the political science sphere, but took Susan McManus's classes, folks like that. Were any of them influences in terms of, I want to go see about this fellowship?
Yeah, I took Dr. McManus's class too. That was a wonderful experience. I had several. I mean, the guy, his name is Dr. John Daly, who's still at USF. He was the director of the MPA program when I was there. He kind of became a quasi-mentor. He helped me get into the master's program and was very, I'm just a kind human being, very wanted to be helpful. I was very helpful. We still stay in touch to this day. So he was a big part of that experience. But the funny story about athletics is athletics provided something different for me. That was a wonderful experience. But what I learned early on was that they had a different end game. And that end game was to provide academic excellence to the extent that they can, but also get their kids graduated with the highest GPA they possibly can.
Yeah.
So that would include taking classes that were of no benefit to the actual student athlete. So the experience that I had early on in my college career was I was meeting with, so we had all these quote unquote academic advisors that were assigned to student athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady that was assigned to me, super nice lady, they just put you in classes. So every semester you just got your sheet. Those are your classes, and you go to those classes. And I remember seeing my classes. I looked at them. I was meeting with her, and I said, "What's this women's studies?" And she's like, literally, she said, "Well, it's a pretty easy undergrad class. It counts for X, Y, and Z, whatever you need to do for your undergrad. And there's like 40 other football players in it, and it's an easy A." And I remember looking at her just like, "Well, right. I don't want to take women's studies.
Right.
Nothing against it, but it has nothing to do with my major, and I don't have any interest in it." And she said, "Well, it's super easy. You should take it." Or just kind of gave me the line that she typically feeds to other people. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. So I dropped that class, did on my own, put in my own class. And from that point on, I did all my own classes. I never relied on academic advisors to do that. And that was very atypical for the situation. As far as I know, there was nobody that did that. You know, everybody just kind of took the classes that were given to them. And I was like, so the result of that is I was in all these classes like con law and all these other things in my undergrad that had no athletes. So for especially the second half of my undergrad, I didn't have a single athlete in any of my classes.
Wow.
So it was a good experience for me because it was a bit of a reprieve. It goes back to what I said earlier about a balanced life in college. It gave me the opportunity during the day to be a real college student, not a student athlete with a bunch of other football and basketball players in my class. I was doing my own thing, taking my own classes, meeting my own people. And then in the afternoon, that was football. And that was my divided life. And then in the evening was my other social stuff, my girlfriend, my fraternity stuff to the extent that I had time to do that.
All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADS protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADS have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right. Their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, let's get back to the episode. Let's move to after you get out of college, you finish the fellowship, which is a cool program. They have some cool programs in that regard. I want to get to your work up here in your first job, but I want to ask, was there a point in that transition from school and fellowships and things like that to environmental issues? When did that particular policy area start to interest you? Was it when you started in the governor's office later doing legislative affairs?
Yep. So shout out to the Florida Gubernatorial Fellowship. I'm still involved in that program. It's still in its existence. It's now been in existence for over 20 years, started by Jeb Bush. I cannot say enough about the program. I mean, there's no doubt another instance where you look back on your life and you figure out points that change your life. That was something that changed my life. I mean, that provided me opportunity in Tallahassee, met people that I otherwise wouldn't have met. Most importantly, created a transition from my athlete-driven life to professional life. Mm-hmm. Like that was the transition, the Florida Gubernatorial Fellowship. Put on a suit every day or multiple times a week, tied ties, went to work in a professional setting. So that would absolutely change my life, got me my first job. So because of the Gubernatorial Fellowship, I got a job working in the governor's office. So I worked for Governor Scott, now U.S. Senator Scott, for a few years in his legislative office because of the fellowship. And shout out to John Costello, who was my first boss, Derek McGee, who was my second boss, and just wonderful human beings. And they're really the ones that gave me the advice to say, like, listen, man, you've been here for a few years. You've kind of, well, would love for you to stay forever, but you've outstayed your welcome. I mean, there's nothing else you can do here. It was a very low-level job.
Sure.
Go get some policy experience. So I went, and they allowed me to go get it myself, like fight for myself. They didn't give me the job, but they said, there's a couple deputy LAD jobs that are open. Here's the few, and go interview for them and see what you think. So one of them was DEP. I went and had lunch with a guy named Pierce Schuessler, who's still in the process. Mm-hmm. And he was my boss and so he ended up hiring me. I went out and worked at DP. So again, like that weird transition from what's next, how do you figure, for me, DP was the natural fit, but had that job not been open, they weren't going to force me into DP.
Right.
So the job was open, it was kind of serendipitous, decided it was a good fit, went out, and the rest is history. So I was there for several years, did a bunch of different jobs, and ended up becoming the LAD and on the leadership team and learning about the agency, was there for a number of years.
Let me ask you this. Talk about it. Though you were not in a particularly high level job, you were in plaza level. I did a lot of that the same time that you were there, but up in OPB. And so being around that, I'm curious in terms of what you take from the work that you participated in, saw happening there out to DEP, because they're two different missions, really, right?
They are. And what was interesting about working in the governor's office at that age is I was working 10 paces from the governor in his office when I was 23 years old. So there wasn't really a slow ramp up time of transition between your college life and your kind of graduate school to professional life. It was right there, right in front of me. But it was a great experience because I got to see both the policy side working in legislative affairs and the political side, because it was left to me to do a lot of the grunt work, set up events, call members, get members there. So I was interacting, and because even though I was 23, I was still calling from the governor's office, from Plaza.
Yeah.
I wasn't calling from OPB even. I was calling from Plaza and say,
yeah,
hey, the governor's coming to this thing. Do you want to go? Hey, the governor wants to meet with you, even as a part of briefing the governor, which I did a lot of that, which was cool. John and Derek were great about involving me in things. And so that was a great experience because it kind of thrust me into, this is how government works at its highest level at a young age. Moving out to the agency, it was invaluable to have come from that job because I realized how the high levels of government function and who's making decisions and why are they making those decisions. So working in an agency, I never got frustrated by the things that may have happened in the governor's office because I knew why they were making those decisions. And I knew the chain of command and how to follow the chain of command and, right. and how all that works. So even though I was working at a very low level and that on Plaza, it was a great transition to do that then to the agency, and the governor's office trusted me, right? So I was in a semi-quasi advisor on a lot of those topics as well with the governor's office. So it was a good transition. But at the same time, I learned the agency, which mm-hmm. for my current job is invaluable. I learned how the agency functions, worked with all the folks that are still there, yeah. et cetera.
Yeah, talk about a little bit in terms of the ease, I would say the greater ease of transition from one job to the next, going into an agency, but your job is spending a lot of time with legislators, basically acting as the translator for an agency for the governor's policy on the environmental budget policy issues with legislators. But you had already some muscle memory for not being as uncomfortable in that transition as somebody else. Meaning it's like, your hardest part was probably learning the agency, not dealing with legislators, right?
That's right. Yeah, I've actually always said that the best, if you want to become a lobbyist, the best training ground is to be a legislative director in an agency, because the obviously for me, the transition was helpful to go from the governor's office to DEP. But for someone who wants to go from an agency to a firm or in-house somewhere, you need to learn the functions of lobbying. So you are the mouthpiece between the agency and the governor's office and the legislature. But beyond that, you're actually lobbying. You're actually running bills. You're focusing on budget and getting things in the budget, et cetera, all right. the things that we do on a day-to-day basis today, I was doing at the agency. I was just doing it for a state agency on behalf of the secretary, on behalf of the governor, et cetera. So to me, that's the best training ground. I mean, working as an aide and working in some of these high levels of government, that's great, but then if you transition that into a lobbying role, it doesn't always cross over. It doesn't always, the function of how do I be a good lobbyist doesn't always transition that well.
Yeah.
And so I've seen that over and over and over again. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, my God, that guy knows everybody, but he doesn't actually know how to lobby. So being able to do both well is obviously difficult, but you're 100% correct. I mean, I kind of already knew how all that stuff functioned. I knew how to do it, which allowed me to get thrown into the mix quickly, but I needed to learn the agency. I needed to learn. And still to this day, I'm no expert. I mean, it's the bulk of what I do, but I'm not a biologist. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a hydrologist, yeah. but I know how to operate in that world. And I know the people to go to if I don't know the answer. So it was the best of both worlds.
Let's talk about the art/craft of lobbying. And it's one of those things that's like when you talk about the transition from doing it, whether it's inside or doing something else on the inside of government. I've done a lot of the something else inside of government and transitioning that to outside. It is difficult if you're not used to what goes into that. And so talk about the art of having difficult conversations with people of how do you ask for the thing? And I say that because you deal with all various and sundry clients from all walks. I know you do a lot of environmental stuff. You and I do some of that together, but you do a bunch of other things that aren't that. Mm-hmm. And so talk about a little bit about how you took that ability to have difficult conversations from the inside and take those back out.
So I think a lot of it is personality. You have to have the right personality to be able to manage your emotions and manage the subject. Also knowing your audience. The audience of lobbying a legislator, a politician, is different than lobbying an agency staffer, an agency leadership person, et cetera. You obviously need to have credibility to know generally what you're talking about. That's the first thing. But then beyond that, people need to and want to call you back. So part of that is political. How active are you in the political scene? But on the agency side of things, what I've learned over the years is they don't care about politics. And they're not driven by politics. They're driven by how much they like you, how much they trust you. Can they tell you information? Will you share stuff with them that may be valuable to them? Mm-hmm. And then are they going to prioritize your needs? Because ultimately what lobbying is getting things done, but getting things done in the order that you want them to be done.
Yeah.
And agency folks, especially the ones that you and I talk to, are busy all the time. You were there, I was there, mm-hmm. you were at a higher level than I was. They're busy all the time. And so they may have at any given time 25 things on their plate, and you need to be able to convince them that yours needs to be top five. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge, right? Especially if you're constantly talking to the same people over and over and over again,
yeah.
saturated in one business, that can be a challenging thing to do. But it really, I found successes in just being kind to people, being respectful of people, being thankful for their time and their ability to help you and want to help you, and just picking up the phone and listening, right? Because at the end of the day, your clients have all sorts of different needs, but ultimately you're the conduit between your client and that person. Could be a legislator, it could be a legislative issue, a bill, or could just be mm-hmm. agency staff, or could be both.
Yeah.
And just being kind about the approach. I mean, I can't tell you how many people, especially in the agency world, they tell me all the time, yeah, you know, you're so nice to work with and such a joy. And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, oh man, we get calls all the time from people, and if we don't give them the answer they want, they just start threatening us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you hear that all the time. It's like, how is that possible that somebody thinks that that's going to work?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't get what I want, so I'm just going to threaten you and say, I'm going to get to elevate this to your boss, as if your boss isn't going to take the word of that person at X agency over you, the lobbyist.
Right.
It's just insanity, right? And so that happens all the time to these people, and it's crazy. So just be kind and respectful.
Does that go back, some of that failing go back to not being able to manage your emotions well? Because the stakes can be pretty high in what we do on this end of the table. But I think, and it sounds to me, it's like, and it's one of the things I appreciate about you is it's the similarity in terms of we're doing this. These are longitudinal relationships with other human beings. And so sometimes people say no to each other. You try to eliminate as many of the reasons as possible for someone to say no, but it can happen. And then it's the only thing that you control then is your emotions or how you react to that. Is that fair?
That's fair. And I think you're right. I mean, there's a human interaction between you and your client and managing your client. There's a human interaction between the people that you're talking to, whether it's an easy ask or a difficult ask. And it's managing and maintaining those relationships over the long term, because many of those people have been there and will continue to be there for mm-hmm. a long time. But a lot of it too, I think, is the responsibility of the consultant/lobbyist to explain these things to their client and to be very honest with their client. Mm-hmm. If you're constantly a yes man or a yes woman, and your client tells you to do something, you just say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, without any sort of interaction between you and the client on, is this doable or not, mm-hmm. then you're doing a disservice to your client, right? So having tough conversations. And by the way, if you have a client that is disrespectful to you, it goes both ways. Mm. Being able to make the difficult decision to say, I really like you, but I don't want to work with you anymore. So we're going to terminate this relationship. And that's also difficult because that means money out of your pocket.
Yeah. Let me ask you that question then, to that point. Do you have to like your client to take their money?
You do not have to like your client, but you need to have a professional working relationship with your client. And that includes respect on both ends, understanding that you have a job to do. There's a trust factor in that you're going to do the job to the best of your ability, and you're going to work your butt off to get there. But if that then includes screaming and shouting and profanities, whatever, it's okay to say, I've appreciated working with you. I like your issues, but I cannot work with you as a person. And again, that's why I think it goes both ways, to say, I'm going to move on. And I've done that a few times, and other people have done that a few times, and it's not easy to do, but it's important to do. It really is.
Yeah. Cause I think in the end, it's like, you've got to go home and you have your clients, and it has to be something that in the end you can live with, because money is just money in that sense.
And that also can include issues as well.
I mean, I was going to ask that question.
Never take on issues that you don't feel comfortable taking on. I have turned down plenty, and I'm sure you have as well. And that's okay to say, I don't think I can do any sort of service here because this is not doable. Or B, I don't agree with what you are asking me to do, so I'm not going to do it. And that's okay too. It's about the long-term integrity of your profession and you as a professional.
Do you have to care about the issue?
No, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of it depends. That's a personal question. It's funny, I often get asked by students when I speak with students, whether it's at USF or FSU or whatever, and they ask me that question, well, what if you don't personally believe in this issue? And I said, well, that's a personal decision. You don't have to be passionate about an issue, but you also don't have to say, I personally want this. Like, I feel passionate enough that I'm going to say yay or nay. So there, it's a personal decision, but you don't necessarily have to care about it either. But it could be something that's important to your client.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you got to decide if it's something you want to take on. But it's a personal decision.
Yeah, I think in the end, it's just a matter of, are you comfortable with the amount of work that you're giving to that client and that issue because they're paying you to? And if you don't want to accept the money, you don't want to do the thing, then don't take their money.
That's right. And I think that you and I are both fortunate that we get to work on a lot of things that we really feel passionate about.
Yeah.
That's not always the case in this profession. A lot of people get into some sort of policy space because that's where they worked before. They worked at some agency. They didn't care about it. But I personally care about almost all the issues that I work on. You do as well.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
They're in a great space, in the environmental space. But I've also turned down issues that mostly for the reason that I don't think I can get it done or it's too untenable. It's like I'm not just going to take somebody's money because they think it's a great idea. And if I think I can't do it or if it's not a doable task at hand. Then I don't.
There's something to be said for that, right? Is just because somebody wants to pay somebody to do something doesn't mean that you ignore the fact that you've got to be honest with them and say, that's not a thing I can do for you. Maybe there's somebody who can work that sort of sorcery, but it's not me. And it takes, I think, a certain amount of self-discipline. And I think you probably see that a whole lot more than I do, in fact, because being at such a large firm, you get a lot of that. You've got to get a lot of that. People coming through the door, and they may have a checkbook that can afford it, but it doesn't matter. You could take somebody's money for 6 months or a year, knowing that you'll do nothing, or the moral thing to do is say, I can't do this.
That's right. And I think there's also an element of you explaining those things to the client. And oftentimes what they'll say is, well, what's our success rate? And you can, if you want to, you can try to put a percentage on it and say, well, I think our success rate potentially is 10%. Mm-hmm. And be honest with them. And if they then decide, well, the 10% is worth whatever I'm going to charge them to do that, take it on if you want. But it's a very personal decision. You don't have to take on issues that you don't feel comfortable taking on or that you don't feel like you can be successful for your client.
You're still a very young guy. You're still at the front end of your career. People like me, when we get to already start thinking about what does the exit strategy look like, what does that look like to you? There are a lot of, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but there are some times when you think that somebody has held on to a career in politics, specifically Florida politics, hold on too tightly. For too long. What does a successful career look like to you? You've got three young daughters, a wonderful wife. It's a great town. I mean, Tallahassee is a great place to live. What does that look like for the future? This, or you're gonna join the family business and run for office someday?
I pretty much eliminated the idea of running for office. But yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I'm 36 years old. I've been doing this for a long time, it seems, but I haven't really thought about the ramp down, I think. But to your question about people that hold on to this business too long, that's certainly a problem. And I think that it's important for people to recognize that this is a young person's game. There's a lot of hustle associated with it. There's late nights sometimes, not necessarily just out drinking, but dinners and things. And so it is a young person's game. But I think the challenge is that you can really ramp it down. You can go from representing 30 clients to 5.
Right.
And do it, quote unquote, part-time for an extended period of time, which is why you see a lot of folks that are well into their 60s and 70s that are doing this work. But I do think that there's an element of service to your clients. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you want to put together a good work product, maintain your relationships, maintain your responsibility to your clients. And there's a point where you're getting diminishing returns. You're just doing it because you can do it versus actually servicing your clients. So I do think there's a ramp down period. I haven't really given a lot of thought to what I do next. As you said, I have three young girls. You've been married for a long time, and we love Tallahassee, and I don't have any plans to change that at this point.
Talk about those old guys a little bit. Because
what's the old? How old? What's the threshold?
I think the experience. Let's use our mutual very good friend, Frank Bernardino, who just retired, and he's going to have many years ahead of him outside of this, and he'll do a little bit of this. We hear him on the phone. He gets on some meetings, but it's usually from some place like across the Atlantic or his place in New Mexico. How much do you rely on people with that kind of experience, not just in lobbying, but in the thing that we care the most about, which is these environmental issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think having the experience of working with guys like Frank and those that have been around for a long time, I think is invaluable because they've been through multiple administrations, worked at places like the Water Management District and local governments that have huge environmental programs. But also this experience of working in very nuanced areas like the budget. Things in the budget haven't changed, right? That process has remained the same probably for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Technology's made it a little bit more easy to kind of manage with lobby tools and things. But by and large, so the process part of the game, the relationship part of the game is fantastic. And I think Frank's a good example of someone who got a long, valuable career and then decided that this wasn't his identity. I think that's the key is as soon as you make this job your identity, meaning all of your social functions are with other lobbyists and legislators, all of your trips are because of political fundraisers or things alike, and it becomes your identity, then it's hard to step away from it. So I think it's important to have a separate life and not make it your identity, but also, again, recognize that this is a young person's game, and it's okay to have a 30-year career and retire at 60 or 65 and say, I've done a great job, I've done a lot of good things, I passed a lot of good bills, I'm going to go ahead and move on, leave us to the next generation. So just like anybody else in their career. I think there's also something to be said with people that want to do it over the long term because it's a fun job. I mean, they want to, they know they can stay in it part-time and they do it between their 60s and the early 70s. And they're like, well, I can do this part-time for the next few years and it's fun. You know, I enjoy it. So why would I leave? But I do think there's a point of diminishing returns. There's no doubt about it.
Obviously, I've been doing this, being around government environmental issues for almost pushing 25 years now. And I made a lot of really good, real friends over those years, but it's certainly not who I am. And so it's, at some point, it's when it stops being fun, that's when, in my mind, it's like that's the moment when you start to look at, like, do I do something else or do I do this simply because I'm able to.
Yeah. Well, there's always a function, I think, of maybe having, if you didn't plan financially, maybe you have to do it, and that may be unique for some people or not. But
sure.
But I do think at the end of the day, you got to always remember that your job is to service your clients. Your clients pay you a lot of money to get results.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get lazy on that fact and lazy on the job at hand, that's when it's time to just go do something else.
I think that's a good spot to transition to the lightning round. What professional accomplishment are you most proud of so far?
Honestly, it's the last 8 years working at Capital City has been great, and I've passed a lot of great bills and done a lot of cool things. Obviously very proud of that, but I'm also very proud of my government service. I mean, just doing a lot of cool things on the inside, working with a lot of great people. And what you realize when you step out of that is you realize that you actually did effectuate quite a bit of change for a lot of people. So I think the kind of that general response that I'm proud of the things we did on the inside, I think is my answer.
I normally wouldn't ask the next question of somebody as young as yourself because it's an ask to look back. And so, but you actually have a good number of years on your belt because you started in it so young. Looking back so far, is there something or things that you may have done differently if you'd had the chance to go back and try that again?
I don't know. I mean, I think you look back and you think maybe there's more I could have done in my sports life. Maybe there's something different I could have done in my professional life. But I try not to dwell on those kind of things. I mean, honestly, my honest answer is I don't regret the decisions that I made. I mean, any one of those decisions could have gone differently and it could have been worse. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's the way I look at it, right? So happy about the decisions I made thus far. My wife and I are providing a good life for our kids. And I think that's, at the end of the day, the most important. That's what creates your identity. And we're proud of the work that we've accomplished together. But any one of those decisions that I would have made early on, I could have made differently. And it could have changed the course of where I went, where I lived, mm-hmm. who I met. You just never know.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Are you optimistic about the future of the environment in Florida?
I am. I mean, listen, I think we made a lot of big mistakes over the course of basically 100 years in Florida, starting at the latter part of the 19th century all the way through, you know, really the 70s. We didn't really have a clue about what we were doing to wetland habitat. We didn't have a super good clue about what's the problem with septic tanks and overdevelopment and a lot of these ag issues. I mean, there's just a lot of bad things we did. But we now know the things that we've done probably are pretty problematic, and we're fixing them. We're not going to be able to fix all of them, and it's going to certainly be expensive, but I'm optimistic about what science is driving and what we now know about all the important functions of the environment. The challenge is going to be, what do we do with all these people? I mean, at the end of the day, we all cause these issues. You know, we are, our existence is what causes these problems. We drain the resource. We use the resource. We're all a part of the problem, all of us. And there's a lot of people coming to Florida, and we got to figure out how to manage the resource. We can do it. We certainly can do it. And we've done a good job integrating innovation into that, but it's going to become more and more difficult as we move forward.
Yeah. And that was the really going into the, and I agree. But that goes into the next question, which is that what you're the most worried about in terms of the environment for the future, is that somehow innovation doesn't keep up with the need to take on so many more people and protect the environment?
I think it's possible, but I'm a man of faith and I'm a big believer that God created the earth for our use. He created the animals for our use. We're living, right? We're all living, breathing organisms. We require water, we require shelter, all the things that we need. So that's not going to change. It may be a deflection from one state to another. Obviously, a lot of people moving to Florida because of low taxes, cost of living, wonderful environmental conditions, whatever. Mm-hmm. So all that stuff is going to be a challenge, but it's going to happen, which is more people create more people, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the things that we didn't have to worry about 100 years, we're going to have to worry about now. And the challenges are going to change between today and the next 50 or 60 years. So how do we innovate and how we change? But I'm very optimistic about what the future looks like.
What advice would you give young people who are thinking about entering, we'll say the environmental field, mm-hmm. because that's what the show is about. I mean, you can kind of mix in the lobbying part as well if you want, but I'm more interested what you would tell them. What do you tell your daughters when they start imagining what they end up being when they grow up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the advice is there's a tremendous need for smart people to come up with smart solutions. I mean, that includes smart solutions in the water resource space, smart solutions in the air quality space, smart solutions in how do we restore our natural resources space. I mean, my advice is, listen, if you care about these issues, pursue them. That doesn't mean you have to be a lobbyist, right? I mean, there's plenty of smart biologists and hydrologists and other scientists that also could probably be lobbyists. It's not rocket science. But if you're passionate about the subject area, go pursue it. It's something you care about. But do it for the right reason. I mean, don't do it because you want to save the world or you want to save all the environmental issues. Do it because you want to actually change. You mm-hmm. want to do some good things, understanding that, again, we're all going to be here. We're all draining the resource. How do we live in existence? Do it for the right reasons and do it if you're passionate about it. Pursue it for sure.
Sounds like good advice to me. Andrew Ketchell, thanks so much for coming on the show, brother.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you having me.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. And thank you once again to Rez and Sea and Shoreline for making it possible. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod, and you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.